Silver Screen Podcast. What do you want?
Hey there, cultists. What fish, you ask? Another episode of Cult Classics right in the middle of the month? That's right, we're spoiling you, you lucky people. Why, you may ask? Well, sometimes shit happens, someone's got to deal with it, and who are you going to call? That's right, with Ghostbusters Frozen Empire due to appear in cinemas, we couldn't just let it pass without getting into the spirit of things, pun not intended, here at Silver Screen. And hey, even popular movies can be cult movies. So with that, we're getting in a special bonus episode as we take a look at the original 84 horror comedy classic. I'm DK, your host on this one. See what I did there? But fear not, I'm not alone to deal with both the undead and civil servants. Call it fate, call it luck, call it karma. Like the originals, there's four of us in the studio today to discuss this one. First up, it's the heart of the Silver Screen podcast. It's Mr. Mike Wilson. How are you doing, fella?
I'm doing okay, yeah, not too bad. Interesting to be here as a guest for this one and not have any of the responsibility, so I'll try and behave.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. You were umming and ahhing about this one, so you're glad to be here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always glad to be here to talk anyway. You know, I mean, it's what we do, isn't it, podcasting? So happy to talk about almost anything except that one time you made me watch Buckaroo Banzai.
Awesome. Next up, we've got another first timer on the show. I'm not sure if she collects spores, molds, and fungus, but I'm sure she'll let us know if that's the case. It's Suzanne. Can you tell the listeners a little about yourself?
Well, I'm a longtime nerd, and I'm kind of your Zed more of the group. I'm in it for a paycheck kind of person. So, yeah, I've been longtime nerd ever since the late 70s with Star Trek and Star Wars, and Ghostbusters is just eminently quotable, you know? So I'm always quoting it in day-to-day life.
Great stuff. And last but certainly not least, not only is he a film buff, but he's a filmmaker. He's another first-timer on the show, and he's graciously taking time out to be with us today. It's Michael Whaley. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great, mate. Thanks for joining. It's good as you. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Just happy to be here. Love talking movies, especially fantastic ones like Ghostbusters. And can't wait to get into it with you guys.
Nice one. Again, do you want to tell those listening a little bit about yourself?
Also a lifelong nerd, at least as far as I can remember. I don't know. I've always just loved movies, and from when I was a little kid, never was something that I thought I'd be making movies at one point, even working at Blockbuster when I was 18 or 19. Yeah, I just love movies, making them and watching them, so, and talking about them.
Nice one. Well, as any regular listeners to the show will know, for those new to the cult classics, we always have one question to give to them to get the ball rolling. It helps to know their tastes. And on behalf of Mike and myself, it continues our little ongoing wager. So I'm going to pose this to both you, Michael, and Suzanne, put you on the spot. I'm going to ask you guys, if you had to choose just one movie that you consider a cult classic as your favorite, what would that movie be and why? And I'm going to come to you first, Suzanne.
I'll go with Clue. I absolutely love Clue. Anytime it's on, or if I'm ever feeling like it, it's all, like, I'll just toss it in. I know it almost word for word.
And how about you, Michael?
Well, Clue is amazing, and I literally just got the big anniversary edition Blu-ray for Christmas with a new poster that my wife got me, so it's great. I am going to go with another Tim Curry movie, though, and it's just something that my mom showed me when I was like 13, which, you know, is questionable now, but Rocky Horror Picture Show. There's a lot of stuff that's great, but I mean, I think that one just sits close to my heart a lot. So, and it's so good on so many levels. So
So, yeah, now we know a little bit more about you guys. We'll get right on today's movie, which is, of course, Ghostbusters. It's a 1984 American horror comedy directed and produced by Ivan Reitman, written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis, starring Bill Murray, Aykroyd, and Ramis, together with Sigourney Weaver, Rick Moranis, and Ernie Hudson. The script was based on Aykroyd's own fascination with spirituality and was penned as a vehicle for both himself and Belushi, in which they would venture through time and space battling supernatural threats. Following Belushi's death in 82, and with Aykroyd's concept deemed financially impractical, Ramis was hired to help rewrite the script and set it in New York City, making it more realistic. It was the first comedy film to employ relatively expensive special effects. Filming took place from October 83 to January 84 in New York City and L.A. The movie was released on June the 8th, 1984, to critical acclaim, praised for its blend of comedy, horror, and action. It earned $282 million during its original theatrical run, making it the second highest-grossing film of 84, and until 1990's Home Alone, the highest-grossing comedy of all time. It was the number one film at the box office for 7 consecutive weeks, and one of only 4 films to gross more than $100 million that year. It was one of the most successful comedy films of the 80s, and in the years that's followed, Ghostbusters has remained extremely popular with attempts to recreate the success of the movie, seeing sequels, reboots, spin-offs, video games, and merchandise. Needless to say, the movie has amassed a cult following and is considered to be a cult blockbuster, a popular film with a highly dedicated fan base still active to this day. And Ghostbusters is currently on various streaming services, as always, dependent on your territory, as well as being available in just about every format you can think of. Hell, you can probably watch this thing on a ViewMaster if you're so equipped. So, yeah, this one stands out for me. It was at first for 2 reasons. First one being that it was the very first time I went to the cinema along with friends. Up until that point, I'd always watched movies with family for the standard stuff, you know, Disney films and the like. So it was the only time I'd been off the leash. I felt so incredibly grown up at the time, especially considering it was both a horror movie and a comedy. And secondly, I loved it so much that it's the very first movie, and still to this day, there haven't been many, that prompted a second visit to the cinema. I was back there next week to see this thing again, and I became obsessed. I had the poster, I had the soundtrack, the making of. I joined the damn fan club, for God's sake. I made my own proton pack from a tin of Cadbury Roses and After Eight box, and it was cobbled together in such a way it was only slightly less dangerous than the ones from the movies. So, yeah, safe to say this one sticks in the memories. But how about you guys? What was your first experience of this? And I'm going to come to you first, Mike Wilson.
I can't remember. It was when they started advertising Ghostbusters 2, and the trailers for that started appearing on TV because it was everywhere. It would have been, when was that film released? 89, I think.
Yeah.
So I would have been like 7, 8 years old. And so I remember seeing that and everywhere. Because it was everywhere, I decided, you know, I'm just a sucker for advertisement and I'm very easily led. So I was like, oh, I want to see that film that's just come out in cinemas or whatever. But then my parents were like, well, you can watch it when it comes to video, but we're not taking it to the cinema. And since you haven't seen the first one, we'll go and rent that and you can watch that first. So. We did, and I did, and I remember liking it, but I was more obsessed as a kid with the cartoon, The Real Ghostbusters,
yeah,
which was everywhere. I mean, as you probably know, DK, in the UK, it was constantly on rotation on children's TV and stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, myself and my cousin obviously had all of the toys, which it feels weird at times thinking, like, this movie prompted, like, a load of kids' toys and stuff, but... We had like the firehouse and the Ecto One and the toy action figures and everything. So, yeah.
Nice one. What about you, Whaley?
Well, I was 4 when it came out, so I did not see it at the theater, unfortunately. It's a regret I have, obviously. I think it was something similar to Mike's with I think the second one was coming out and I was like 9 or 10 and I asked about it. I saw a commercial and asked about it. And my mom and were like, hey, well, if you're going to like this one, we're going to see this one first. We went and rented it. And then, so I saw that when I was like 9 or 10. And I think we also grew up very poor. So I think we also waited just for it to come out on video for the second one too, before I saw it. Cause I As a child, I didn't go to the theater much, but I did a few times. But I know I didn't see Ghostbusters 2 at the theater. So, but yeah, it's very similar. That I just saw a preview for part 2, and then I knew about the cartoon and stuff like that. And they were like, "Well, watch the first one," and I did, and I was, you know, "Whoa, this is amazing!"
And what about you, Suzanne? Any memories for this?
Well, I suspect I'm the oldest of the group. I was 10 when it came out. But kind of weird because I grew up in the woods of Pennsylvania, and with a, I'm not going to say deeply religious, but Pentecostal family. So you didn't go see movies about ghosts. But for some reason, it caught my mom's eye. And if it caught my mom's eye, we were allowed to watch it. So she must have decided that we needed to rent it. I don't remember seeing it in the theater. But I do remember watching it before watching the TV cartoon series. But I did love the cartoon series. It was one of the ones that just seemed to stick with me and just really enjoyable. And then after that, I got to see, you know, decided for myself, I got to see that the movies in the theater. I did not go see the reboot in 2016, let me just say. That did not catch my eye at all. I kind of had that pegged for what it was. But yeah, I absolutely loved the movie. And it, and again, it kind of fits in. I don't mean to bring this whole point of view to the whole thing, and I'm not trying to bring it down, but there was that whole scare with you know, the Christians and everything ghosty and everything Dungeons and Dragons. And that was kind of my life at the time. And you felt a bit like a rebel going to see this movie. And but it was actually very well done, very funny. And, you know, you got to love the Marshmallow Man at the end. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I, like I said, I don't remember seeing it in the theater the first time, but I do remember seeing the other one, the second one, and then Afterlife in the theater. So.
Well, as to our previous episode, Dune, it's been 40 years since this one's released. Kind of hard to believe both of those came out the same year, to be honest. Do you think it's aged well? Do you think it holds up? Have your impressions changed since you first saw this thing? And I'm going to open the floor to anybody who wants to jump in on this one.
Oh, yeah, I think it's held up very well. It seems to ring like a classic. There's nothing that really dates it. Even the vehicles, because they chose a vehicle from the 50s, there's no way to actually date this movie now, you know, just by the vehicles or by what they're wearing. And yeah, I think it holds up really well. The dialogue's not too trendy or full of jargon or any kind of slang of the time. It's very well written, and yeah, I think it holds up well.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it holds up well with the exception of some of the special effects, but for the time and what it is, it's still fantastic. But yeah, like other than like the only thing that dates it to me is like especially the scene in Rick Moranis's Lewis Tully's apartment with the when the as he's like who brought a dog when it's coming through the door and everything else like that. Yeah. It's like it lands on the table with all the food and stuff like that. Very, I mean, the effects there were, or like I said, still held up for long periods of time, but in today's standards, obviously, they're not as great. But other than that, yeah, everything's still fantastic with it.
And yeah. Just to be awkward, and conversely, I think the parts of it haven't held up all that well. I think a lot of it does, and I would say the special effects 90% do, the likes of the vehicles and the production design and everything does, but I think controversially, perhaps, I don't think Venkman would fly as a hero today. He's very iffy.
Oh.
Well, I don't know. He was still, I guess you would consider woke with some things. He's like, oh, I'm not going to take advantage of you, even though I want to be with you because you're possessed. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, he doesn't take advantage of things or stuff like that, but it's borderline too much. And I think that
the two movies, there's growth. And I think that is the point, is that he starts off with people and then eventually settles down with Dana. But like I said, I think a lot of the stuff that we find funny from our generation, from the start of the movie in particular, the whole like experiments and telling the, you know, hot female, oh, you're guessing everything right, and then electrocuting the guy, that kind of scene nowadays, you're not going to get away with doing that from your hero as like your introduction and still find it funny and not just be like, this is just really creepy, man.
As a female, even from the start, I was creeped out by him, especially with his how he was treating his co-ed. That was just wrong, man. But as it progressed, you could see the gentleman, because hey, he's now faced, instead of with these teeny bopper college age girls, he's now faced with a real woman who has a real opinion, who can walk away and has no problem with it. And now all of a sudden he stepped up his game. I was kind of keeping an eye on that. I watched both the first and second ones last night, and I was keeping an eye on that aspect. And that's exactly what he's doing. All of a sudden he's like, hey, wait a minute, this is a real woman. I don't know what to do with those. Let's be a gentleman here and let's not tick her off or she'll go away, you know?
Yeah. I read a thing, an article, it was a review of the original Ghostbusters quite a while ago, and they were slagging it off because they were saying, looking back, it kind of infantilizes men. They say that's why it appeals to kids as such, because you're watching these grown men and these grown men are just acting like kids. And my first thought was, does this person not know any grown men? Because that's exactly how I live day to day. And if I had the money that Ray had, I would be buying that firehouse.
For sure.
I think part of it, though, is that they're all such narrowly drawn, almost stereotypes. Like, it's fantastic that they have such a mix of characters, but at the same time, they never go outside of their box so that you can immediately identify, like, as a kid, oh, Egon's the brainy one. Ray is the serious one who's just luckless. Peter is the one everybody's going to like because he's the sassy, smart mouth guy. Winston is the whole, you know, oh, I don't even want to be here, but I'm here for a paycheck type guy. And they never really step outside of those roles.
Yeah. Ernie Hudson himself, he said, I love the character and he's got some great lines, but I felt he was just kind of there. He says, I'm very thankful to Ivan for casting me and I'm very thankful that fans appreciate the Winston character. But it's always been very frustrating and kind of a love-hate thing, I guess. And I think that was partly down to the fact that when he took the script, it was originally written for, obviously, Murphy. And then he took the role. And then the Winston character was really narrowed down for the next revision.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of see why you would. When you've got Bill Murray improvising and doing something kind of special, I get why you would increase his role. But the fact that it's at the expense of, as you said, the person of color, because it's not Eddie Murphy, and so you're just like, oh, well, we'll narrow his role down. I mean, it's 45 minutes into an hour and 45 movie before he shows up, which is pretty dodgy.
Yeah. I do believe...
thrown in.
Yeah, I do believe that... The script originally, it was Winston that got slimed in the Sedgwick rather than which, I mean, it comes up. I mean, obviously, there were quite a few names tossed around for this one. I mean, I couldn't believe that Michael Keaton was up for the role of both Venkman and Egon Spengler. But, yeah, obviously, you had Belushi, you've got Eddie Murphy, you've got John Candy, who were all up for this. How different do you think it would have been?
I mean, I think it still would have come across like it does, like an almost SNL-type movie, because they're all talented comedians and they would have done their thing. So it wouldn't have been that different, especially considering Ramis and Reitman's script was quite tight. And it kind of keeps it manages to keep the horror element without the comedy seeming to undercut it, which a lot of comedy horror doesn't do. Which it always strikes me when I'm watching it, like when you get to the scenes of, oh, the apocalypse is coming and the skies are getting dark and we freed the ghost, it's actually... The film itself takes that moment really seriously, as opposed to playing it just like, uh-oh, wacky, all the ghosts are out. And you can be sarcastic and funny amongst that, as they are, but I think you risk just veering into complete slapstick, and I don't think anybody that you mentioned would have done that. They would have had that kind of comedy chops, and they would have kept with that script.
Yeah. I think that's a really standout scene, actually, the one that you bring up. Are you on about the one with Aykroyd where he's talking to Hudson in the car?
Well, partly, yeah, but then after that, when they actually do, like when, you know, Walter Peck or whatever he's called, when he does actually free all the ghosts, and then the film itself, like the music is dramatic and it plays, there's not a gag or anything in it, it just plays it like the demon dogs are unleashing and the sky's going dark and there's lightning. And I was like, this is actually, like, if you just watched this 2 minutes in isolation, this is a horror movie. And the director has the confidence to be like, we don't have to have a joke every 2 minutes. Let's play this moment for what it is. And then we can do the jokes when they're getting interviewed by the mayor. And then they can do the jokes about, like, yeah, this idiot is responsible for this shit, by the way.
Good horror comedies definitely know the balance with that. And I do agree with Mike that with other people in there knowing how they're professionals, it would have been very similar. I mean, there would probably been different, you know, line reads and stuff like that. Something else may have been funny, or something may have been less funnier than what the current, or the iteration we have is, but I think it still would have been good. You know,
yeah.
Writing is the key. I mean, good writing begets everything else at some points.
Yeah. Apparently Candy wanted to play Lois because he was up for the role of Lois. He wanted to play him with a really exaggerated German accent.
I remember reading that.
Yeah, and Reitman said, no, we're not going to go that way. This is a New York comedy. We want a New York. And apparently Candy just didn't want it. So that same day, he gave he sent the script to Rick Moranis. And I believe in like 4 hours, Rick Moranis got back to him and said, I want you to thank John Candy for turning this down because I can use this.
Love Rick Moranis.
So is it? I'm going to ask, does anybody have a standout performer in this that you think just nails it?
Well, I've already said I think Bill Murray basically steals the show, but I think they are aware of that. And I think that maybe, again, I'm bringing a bit much of the actor to the character, but I think at times he is a little bit too aware of it and too smug and too proud of himself, if you know what I mean. So at times it comes off a tad annoying because it's like, give the other character something to do, you smartass. Do you know what I mean?
I think for just knowing who he is and how he is, I mean, it's a smaller part, but I still love the Lewis Tully character. I think Rick Moranis does a fantastic job with that. And being like, you can obviously tell that's like a completely thought out character that he's created in the world, even if it wasn't all there in the script. And the things he brought to it, I'd like to read what the script said for his character and then go back and compare it. But yeah, I think Rick Moranis' Lewis Tully is definitely a standout. I mean, they're all so good. Sigourney Weaver's amazing in it, and you know.
I was just going to say, I think Sigourney Weaver would be the other standout because it's such a different role. Like, she was so known for Alien and the kind of horror badass female sort of lead character that taking a supporting role without any of those kind of sort of things hanging off it or any of that pressure. And she's really, really, really good.
And that's the thing. I know she likes doing comedy, and like this would be this. And but of course, in Hollywood, in anything, honestly, even non-Hollywood things, people are like, "Oh, you're the fat funny guy, or you're the so and so," and they don't think you can do anything else. And and that's not necessarily, you're an actor; you can do anything. Yeah. If you really want
even
to.
this movie's like comedy horror, so it's still kind of in the wheelhouse. But she was an absolute revelation when it came to Galaxy Quest. Because she
Well, in my opinion, I do think that Annie Potts kind of came out as a good character, because she's, if you've seen Designing Women, it's definitely not Janine Melnitz, and if you've seen any of her other work, it's definitely not
Neil Sheldon. Does that count?
Well, in that she's a bit more what she was in Designing Women, but like just a little more over the top, I think. But as Janine, you know, you'd heard her with her Southern accent and you didn't know she could do a New York accent, you know? And she was just absolutely believable as a tired secretary, you know?
I did like Ghostbusters, what do you want? Going back to Sigourney Weaver. She did mention, she said that she once had a fire in her apartment. This was after the movie came out. And the firemen came to put it out. And one of them opened up a refrigerator and said, whoa, you better call the Ghostbusters. And talking about the acting, William Atherton, what's everybody's reaction to Walter Peck?
Oh, I hated him so much. He's one of the like three actors from the 80s that just was so good at playing such a asshole character that you just almost didn't like the actor. Like, you saw him in other things, like, oh, this piece of shit, like, it's yeah. It, he was he was so good at playing that character and being Walter Peck that it's just I hated him so much.
Anytime post 80s when you saw that guy in the street, you're gonna be pelting him with like food and stuff. Like, who's a dick?
He said he was actually, the actor was actually furious. He got really upset by how people were treating him in real life. He said he couldn't even go to a bar without people wanting to pick a fight with him.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I just read that too.
Yeah, and he was also walking down a stretch of 7th Avenue in New York City. It was entirely crowded with school buses, and all the children were shouting out of the buses at the top of their lungs, "Hey, Dickless!" I mean, it's directed by Reitman. Obviously, you know, he had form with this. He did Meatballs, Stripes. Later on, he did Twins, Kindergarten Cop. And Afterlife is helmed by, you know, obviously his son, you know, Jason. So,
yeah, Jason.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the direction of this one?
I mean, Ivan Reitman was a fantastic director on many, many comedies. He did do horror and comedy, this and like Stripes. He did action comedy. I guess it is action comedy. He's just very good at comedy and blurring genres. And so, and I thought the direction on this was great.
Any particular standout moments for any of you guys?
The eggs boiling and the dog in the fridge scene, I actually quite like. The montage of the Ghostbusters activity with that cool song, and then it's showing you like magazines and news and Larry King and Casey Kasem and stuff like that. And at the end, I noticed there's some actually really brilliantly framed shots, mostly involving Sigourney Weaver, though that might just have been me paying extra attention. It's the way she's framed when she's like laying on the thing, or when she's stood like next to the altar and stuff. I was like, these are like paintings almost, and it's a fantastic. It's a good eye to have with a director to know where to frame these things. Plus, I mean, the sense of scale that the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man has, which is so weird when you think it is just a guy in a suit, but it looks huge. And yeah. That's not easy to do without just coming across as, oh, it's a bad green screen of a dude in a suit.
Production design on this is really well, with the exception of, and Michael pointed it out earlier, the terror dog when it comes out of Lois's bedroom and then runs across the street chasing him. That hasn't aged well at all. I think everything else pretty much holds up, but that still looks a little suspect.
When they're practical effects, like when you can tell when they cut between them, it looks great.
Yeah.
But the problem is it just doesn't move right and doesn't look right. It looks like it was placed in there, of course, afterwards. So yeah, I don't know. It just, yeah, the effects are, but yeah, the practical stuff was fantastic, and I agree, production design was great.
What I appreciated as someone who has studied architecture a little bit is how much the buildings were featured as much as the city itself. Like the architecture of Lewis and Sigourney Weaver's building was Art Deco, and they played up the Art Deco parts, even though it kind of looked a little too 80s-ish. But the way they played up the architecture of the firehouse and the way they played up the architecture of Columbia University, all of those major buildings that they used to frame some of their shots, I thought really added to making those buildings almost characters, because the building that Sigourney was living in was as much a character as the people in the movie. So was the firehouse, you know? And I liked how you got a sense of the scope and a sense of the oldness and like the wood paneling in the firehouse and the clean lines and all of the metal and the stonework of the Art Deco building. And I just really appreciated that. You know, it was even to the point where Aykroyd says, "Oh, Art Deco, very nice," as they're walking through her building.
And apparently the terror dogs were actual statue designs on an old church in Philly. The weirdly enough, the jail scene, talking about physical location, there's a jail scene. It was shot in the prison, and the prison was reported to be haunted. All the dailies kept turning up with scratches all over them with no apparent physical cause. And Reitman was really didn't want to go back there, and the crew was apparently relieved so that they could find enough footage to scrabble together the scene without having to go back.
Oh, wow.
That actually makes sense in hindsight watching that scene. It seems edited like there wasn't a lot of coverage. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. obviously it's Columbia Pictures' highest grossing movie, you know, of all time when adjusted by inflation. And you do get a sense very much that it was capturing lightning in a bottle. So, of course, what's the studio going to do after that? They're going to just try and recreate that. So, obviously, we've had the cartoons, we've had the sequels, we've had video games, we've had the reboots. Do you guys, and I know you've got something to say about this, Mike. Do you guys yep. think it's something that holds up a franchise in that respect? Or do you
no.
think it would have been
much You're stepping on my conclusion here, though. No. Not everything has to be a franchise. And I think it's fantastic that it birthed the cartoon, and that's where it kind of works. And I'm all for that cartoon. You know, I love it. And it was kind of adapted for kids. They took little things like the, you know, the Slimer, Sliming Venkman, and that became a running joke with the cartoon. Great. Love it. All works. But for me, there's yet to be an anyway decent sequel to this movie. And I've seen all three of them, and I just think, no, it doesn't work.
You didn't like it?
Nope, hated it. Absolutely. It was, for me, it was the worst example of let's just do the film again. It brought nothing new to the table, and then it exhumed the dead for an extra insult. No.
I'll just disagree with that. I don't know. Here's the thing. Once they made the cartoon in the second one, it's already a franchise. Like, it's like those were going to be done no matter what. The continuations, like, was the reboot great? No. Did I have fun with that movie? Yes, very much so. Like,
that's probably my most favorite of all the sequels, the 2016 version.
Well, the one thing I will say, though, that I like, because it was already franchised in early 90s, you know, it was already franchised by then. Like, the only thing that continuing with this, as long as they're not straight up ruining it, which I don't feel they are, that it's bringing new people into the fold. Like, my youngest, we went and saw Afterlife at the theater. They completely loved. And it's like one of the things that some people I know that is being said just in nerd culture in general is that this was a kid's, Ghostbusters wasn't a kid's movie, but I'm just saying it's like sometimes with Star Wars people do it, like this was made for kids, it's still made for kids. You know, it's like we're just adults who like some things that are skewed that way and vice versa. So I personally don't have a problem with them continuing stuff like this. I saw the trailer. I'm looking forward to Frozen Empire. I will go see it at the theater.
I will say, Mike, you brought up the fact that nothing's kind of done as well as the first one, story-wise. I know you're not a big gamer, but I've got to bring it up. Has any of you guys played the video game? Yeah, it came out in around 2011, and this was way before Afterlife. And it was written by Aykroyd. And he described it that this is, to all intents and purposes, Ghostbusters 3. And he did a fantastic job, so much that people of kind of Mike's inclination, as in, you know, not liking Afterlife, disregard Afterlife in preference of the Ghostbusters, a video game. And it does a really, really great job of tying Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2 into this much larger narrative. And it's voiced by all the actors, I think, with the exception of Rick Moranis, obviously. And it does a really good job. Unfortunately, it's since been retconned by Afterlife, so it's no longer canon. But
yeah,
if you love that universe and you like playing in that universe, I do recommend trying to get a copy. It's really fun.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we've talked on the you know, production design, we've talked on the acting, we've talked on the directing. Let's, you know, the big thing about this is the writing. Do you think this was a much better option in the and how it was filmed than Aykroyd's original idea?
I'd say yes. I think with writing, things change for reasons, and sometimes they're for the better. Sometimes I'd say they're not. But I think in this situation, this would have been, you know, I think this was the right way to go with it compared to the original idea.
Yeah, I think it was too out there. I don't think an audience would have responded to it as much. What about you?
Are we talking the video game versus the new Afterlife?
No. I'm talking about the original draft of Aykroyd's movie, his original script that he wanted, which was they were kind of, it was set in the future, and Ghostbusters at that point would kind of exist like, you know, your normal emergency services, and he would have seen them hopping backwards and forwards through time, fighting ghosts and stuff like that. But it was brought down to this level because they didn't think it was achievable.
Yeah, that sounds a little too ambitious.
Yeah, I agree. I think it might have been fun, but it was clearly like it was never going to get made. It would have cost, even today, that would cost an absolute fortune.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, keeping track of all the time periods that you'd be jumping into and out of. There's a set of books that I really like, but they're a little hard to follow. There's Jasper Ford's Thursday Next series, and she's a literary detective, and she can jump back and forth in time and back and forth out of books. And I'll tell you what, you got to be quick to keep up with it because you're not quite sure where you are sometimes. So I would think that in a movie, that would be very difficult to portray.
I think even now, I don't think audience would be that accepting of it. I think it's got that kind of, you know, even for its eccentricities, it's got more of a grounded feel to it now. And I think that people jumping backwards and forwards would be kind of like a jump the shark moment for most people.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any scenes now or any bits of the writing that you look at and you think that's a fine example of filmmaking? Or conversely, do you look at it and think, oh, a bit cringe?
Not that we haven't already mentioned, really.
Yeah.
I think the effects are probably the bit cringe part.
Yeah. I will say that the line "dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria" was voted number 68 of the 100 greatest movie lines by Premiere back in 2007.
That and the big Twinkie line are both referenced in the 2016 movie as well.
Yes.
One of my favorite small Bill Murray lines, though, is when they're in the ballroom getting Slimer the first time. And he goes, oh, I've always wanted to do this. And he pulls the thing out of it, and everything goes except for the centerpiece. And he's like, you can just hear it. It cuts away. The flowers are still on the table.
Yeah.
Still, like, one of my favorite. I laugh so much at that line every time.
Yeah.
And I know it's coming. I look forward to it.
it's like a little highlight because they don't focus on it. And it's just, it's just there. I love that. So, yeah, which I mean, that brings us to the sound design. It's certainly got its own kind of sound, this thing. But on top of that, it's got Elmer Bernstein doing the score. And I mean, you know, this guy did Killer Mockingbird, Cape Fear, Ten Commandments, Magnificent Seven, Great Escape. He's phenomenal. So to land him, they did a fantastic job. But not only that, to me, it's very 80s, but I still think this thing's got a killer soundtrack.
For sure.
Definitely. And that I Believe It's Magic song really gets me every time. It's just so funky. I don't think I'd ever heard it played on the radio, but in this movie, it's perfect. But it's also such an interesting song. It doesn't sound cheesy, synthesized. Like most 80s music did, but it does sound synthesized, and it's really kind of a bold, slightly creepy sound, and I loved it.
Again, it's another one of those soundtracks that's always been on my player since I first got it, and I first got the album back when the movie came out, so I'm still a big, big fan of Saving the Day by the Alessi Brothers. Can't get enough of that.
Yeah, made a note of that as well. I don't think you could underestimate the impact of that title song either. It's one of those things where, again, like the movie Catches Lightning in a Bottle, that theme song is just, it's perfect. And it sets the tone and the mood so perfectly. It gets used multiple times in the movie. And it just gets you hyped from the moment the movie starts because it's so, like, upbeat and cheerful and matches the tone, I think, perfectly.
Yeah, especially when they're using that montage.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, according to an interview with Mix Magazine, Ray Parker Jr., he tried to create that song in 2 days. And at 4:30 a.m., no doubt, you know, stressing that he couldn't write anything, he saw a commercial for a drain company that reminded him of a scene from the film. And it helped him with the line, "Who are you going to call?" Although later on, I do believe he got sued, and he got sued quite successfully by Huey Lewis and the News for... Yeah. They said it
wasn't successful. I read up on this.
No, apparently it was successful, but then he countersued later on.
Yeah.
And I want a new drug, but I mean, obviously, in every sense of the word, it was a success. It was a blockbuster. By and large, the cult movies we've discussed have been a lot less popular than this one, and that's to put it mildly. While it is considered a cult movie, do you think you can have one that successfully straddles that line between success and cult? And do you think Ghostbusters is a cult classic in your view? And I'm going to ask you first, Wilson.
I'm going to defer because I actually addressed this in my conclusion, so I'll let you hear it then.
No worries. What about you, Wiley?
I do think you can have wildly successful things and still be cult classics, just with the nerddom for them. Like, you know, people, you know, start basically worshiping things as a religion almost. And, you know, it can still be wildly successful because good things are still good. It doesn't have to be a bad cult to be a cult classic, you know. So I think that, yeah, it did it well, but I don't think that they're interchangeable. I mean, I don't think that they're different things. I think they can be both, as this movie to me proves.
Cool. What about you, Suzanne?
I think I agree. I don't see why cult has to mean low budget and low follower, you know, low box office. Cult to me means you've got people behind it and you follow it and it becomes this big collective enjoyment out of it. And I think that's what most really good cult movies are, is, you know, either for better or worse, depending on which, you know, if you like the Mystery Science Theater cult versions or if you like, you know, Clue type cult versions, what makes them followable and what makes them really enjoyable as like with a group of people is that they're quotable and it's good dialogue and very well acted, very well delivered lines, and that the people behind it believe in it. You know, that's what sold Sharknado so well, is, you know, it was meant to be a cult. It was meant to be a spoof. It was meant to be something that was making fun of something else. And it became this whole cult thing all on its own because it's so enjoyable. It's so cheesy that you gotta love it. It's so quotable. It's so, you know, everybody that watches it gets a good time out of it. And I personally think that's what, I mean, my friends and I are always quoting Ghostbusters to each other. You know, every time somebody asks you if you want coffee, you say, yes, have some. Yes, have some. You know, it's things like that that I think make it a cult, is that, you know, you've got a following to it. You know, classic definition of cult is that you've got, it may be out there, but you've got followers for it. I think it can be successful and a cult classic.
Nice. Well, I can safely say that as far as this one goes, we've come, we've seen, and we've kicked its ass. But before we move on, do you guys think there's anything that we may have missed during the discussion? Anything that warrants a mention that you don't think we've covered?
I have to mention it because it's on my avatar and we haven't brought it up. What the heck is the deal with this blowjob scene that's going on with Dan Aykroyd? I'll never understand how they're trying to make a family franchise out of a like raucous 80s comedy where Dan Aykroyd gets a blowy from a ghost.
It did do the dream sequence thing ahead of it. Like that it was just a dream. Yeah. Like the screen goes sort of thing. And also, I mean, if we're going to go other things in the whatchamacallit, Sigourney Weaver says, I want you inside me at one point. I mean, it was to get to Bill Murray's beautiful joke that just like, oh, it sounds like there's already two people in there. That's more than my limit. but one of the things I say we may have overlooked a little bit is just the genius of Harold Ramis. I mean, I know we talked about directing, but I mean him as Egon. Like, yeah. It was very just subtle, that character, but it's so good. Like, and he did such a good job of that, and I didn't want to not at least say something about him.
He could convey a lot with just a look, and I love that about him.
Yeah, for sure. Made it so odd. Made that such good character choices, and you know, I believed that's exactly who he was. Like, great acting.
Cool. Well, in that case, as is the norm, we'll now get to our personal, preferences. So we'll move on to our highlights. I'm going to go straight in and say to you, Suzanne, have you got a favorite character or favorite actor in this one, and why?
Favorite character is definitely Winston. Like I said, I related to him so well. I don't necessarily relate to a lot of the women as well, but the way he thought, and that, you know, he was in it for a paycheck. I'll believe anything for a paycheck. You know, I've worked that way before, and that just hit me so hard, because there's just sometimes that you're so down and there's no, the job that you want's not coming up. So you just take any old thing, and yeah, you'll believe, sure, I'll believe that if there's a paycheck behind it. Sure. As for favorite actor, I think Annie Potts is my favorite, just because I didn't know she had that kind of range before, but yeah, I think Annie just really hits it out of the park.
What about you, Whaley? Do you have an MVP in this?
And it's getting harder for this to be my favorite character because of how problematic it is. And it's super cliche, but it's just because I'm super sarcastic. I related the most to everything other than the creepy side of Vangman. And he's still so funny. And it's just one of those things, and I'm not trying to say I'm overlooking things. Before I knew how creepy that was, you know, when I was a teenager in early 20s and stuff like that, because it's been 40 years. Like, I, of course, didn't notice any of that part of it. And he's just always been there, and I still think he is my favorite character. That he does grow and become better, obviously, but I think Vangman's still that. And my favorite actor, I still think, like I mentioned earlier, I think Rick Moranis. Cool. Is still my favorite in this.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to go with you on character, and it's definitely Vangman. Yes, it is problematic, but I mean, it was my first experience of Bill Murray back then, and the guy just exudes confidence in this, and I think you connect with it. So that's the only thing I can say with regards to this. So what about you, Mike?
I think the same. I think you can't really, unfortunately, although it is cliche and although it is problematic at times, you can't go past Bill Murray as Vangman, although I'm almost loath to say it, not just because of how problematic it is, but because I think it's one of those times where they kind of took the wrong lesson, and it worked this time to let Murray have that kind of freedom and do that improvisation and let him overshadow everyone. But I think that taking that as like, oh, we should do this, has led to a lot of, not just Murray's career, but other actors who have like, I'm going to storm in and take over this film, and it'll all be for, you know, me and my comedy chops. And I don't think that usually works. So I think it was a mistake to think that it was because of that. I think it was more of a fluke, if you know what I mean. But it's hard to deny that Vangman is the key character and the popular one walking away from this movie.
And is there anything about this one that to you is just cinematic perfection, something that makes you love it, be it a scene, line of dialogue, special effect, anything? And I'm going to go back around with this one, so I'll say, go for it, Mike.
Well, with me, I mean, there's a few things that I could mention, and I like the way that the sort of Stay Puft Marshmallow Man is set up early on. I like that they kind of do the Chekhov's Deus Ex Machina across the streams thing. You know, the idea of introducing its own mythology and stuff, the escalation of the story, loads of little funny moments, like the heroic moment and then they're trudging up the stairs, stuff like that. And obviously we've talked at length about all of the lines. We'd be here all day if I started doing that. But, and I've already talked about it, my actual key moment is just how effectively the reveal happens of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man as he first comes around that corner, because like I said, it's a combination of like the humor when you realize what Ray has done, and the ridiculousness of it, coupled with how well-directed it is when it's like, oh, shit, this massive thing is just storming through New York. This is serious, even though it's hilarious. And I think it's the perfect encapsulation of this film, that it's like there's a destroyer that's going to destroy the world. It's also like a friendly sailor corporate mascot, you know?
Nice. I will say, it's for me, it's the hotel scene. That's where, to me, that's where the tone of the movie set. Where Murray says, yeah, you know, let's split up, we can do more damage that way. And I just, from then on, it just kicks it into high gear, and I love that thing. So I'm going to come to you next, Whaley. What's your favorite bit about this movie?
I think the thing that set up everything in the movie, like the hotel scene's great, Stay Puft is great, and I love all those, but it's the opening of the movie in the library when the ghosts, with their interaction with the ghost, and then just running after it scares them, was exactly what any human would probably do. Well, the very first time they're actually like, oh my God, it's a ghost. And then he's like, oh shit, it's trying to get us. And then we'll be back later, you know. Like, that set the tone for the entire thing for me. And it was, that's, I guess, what made it, like, to me, like, I mean, everything else is great. Like, honestly, picking my favorite scene is somebody who's neurodivergent like me. It's almost impossible. Like, I love so many of them in this movie. But yeah, I think that opening scene in the library is what really. It's like, oh, I know what I'm in for. This is going to be great.
I do love how that scene bookends as well, because it's like they send Ray to talk to the librarian ghost. It's like, go on, then Ray, you do it. And then at the end of the film, Venkman does exactly the same with Goza. He's like, we should all talk to her. Well, Ray, he has to have been the luckless one that's like, hi, it's my authority. I'm going to try whatever.
Awesome. What about you, Suzanne? What's your favorite aspect of this film?
I think my favorite aspect of it is that there is a scene where they're just eating Chinese around the table, and they're saying that this represents the last of the petty cash. And that's what hits it home for me in believing that this is just another emergency service. This, because that's exactly how they are at the hospital. That's how they are at the police station. That's how they are at the fire department. You know, they're just sitting around, they're waiting for the call, they're eating probably a very bad meal, and they're looking around at each other, and all of a sudden, that's when everything hits, and they have to jump into gear and jump into action. But it's also, you know, you kind of have that thought of, you know, if you don't have any patients, you don't have any paycheck. If you don't have any ghosts, you don't have a paycheck. And it's that earthiness of it really being an emergency service. And that scene in the firehouse where they're eating the Chinese with the last of the petty cash is what really kind of seals it for me.
Nice. So now you out there know what we like. It's time to hear from you. And don't worry, we're ready to believe you. So yeah, without further ado, I'm going to pass this over to our own brand new Class 5 resident, Vianne. Hey, Vianne.
Thanks, DK. This is Vianne, and I'm reporting to you now from the corner penthouse of Spook Central. Looks like there was quite a bit of discussion, maybe unsurprising due to the classic nature of the Ghostbusters original 1984 and the revival of the franchise with the upcoming Frozen Empire. So, you know, quite a bit of discussion, and it looks like there was a pretty good consensus across the board. I'm looking at the reviews now. 5 out of 5. So I'm just going to hit a few of these. Nick Sergey, 5 out of 5. Let's run some red lights. Tim JT, 5 out of 5. It combined all of the different genres into one movie perfectly. Ryan Reeves, that's what we call a class 5. Full roaming vapor, the best one of the lot, wink. Let's see. Sam Lonsberry, 5 out of 5. It's a solid family movie that doesn't lean too hard into one genre, but balances multiple genres perfectly. It also shows how if you believe in yourself, you can do whatever you want and be whoever you want. Doesn't matter what anyone else says about you, and Winston shows that you don't have to be a scientist or have a higher than average IQ to do it. I would argue Winston probably does have a higher than average IQ, but that's beside the point. Let's see. Craig Hay, 5 out of 5. Gerson Linares, 5. This movie is iconic. I think iconic is probably the one word for this movie, but I'll come back to my own opinion in a bit. Let's see. Chew Innocent, 5 out of 5. Was magical when I was a kid, and now as an adult, it's just wonderful nostalgia. I watch those movies when things get tough, and they help me relax. So many wonderful comments and wonderful reviews from people. Let's see, there was one I really did want to touch on. William Cardona says, 5 out of 5. Apart from growing up watching it, when I started dating my now fiance, she had never seen Ghostbusters. On our third date, I came over to her apartment with my Ghostbusters Blu-ray. She liked it, however, not as much at first. This was November 2019. Fast forward to a couple of months later when the quarantine hit us. We decided not to see each other until this COVID mess cools down for the safety of my parents and her roommate. During quarantine, she would call me just to tell me that she is watching Ghostbusters and thinking of me. Ghostbusters became our bridge when we were apart for a couple of months. We didn't see each other until my birthday in May, and I even had a Ghostbusters party just for me, my family who I lived with, and her. Now in January of 2024, we are getting married in 5 months, and I'm proud to say that our love for Ghostbusters hasn't faded to the point that we have our little mini Ghostbusters section in our place. Who would have thought that this wonderful movie would play a big role in my life and even brought me my future wife, smiley face, life is good. I love hearing that. Ghostbusters, or Ghostbubbers as we call it in our family because my niece couldn't pronounce it right when she was little, has been a part of my life for as long as I remember. I was born in 83, it came out in 84, and I don't remember a time, I was the youngest, so you know how it is with younger kids in the family, we get exposed to stuff earlier than maybe the older siblings, and this was a big movie for my family. It was one we all actually agreed on and laughed about. We still all quote it to this day. My parents were long, long divorced, and it was still something we all agreed on. When I was really little, we were in New York City, and we were walking, and I saw I must have been 3 years old. We saw the library with the lions, and I just screamed Ghostbusters because I was so excited. And I think that this movie comes from a time when you could do a lot more in a family way without having to sanitize everything. And I think when so many people are like, oh, it crossed so many genres, it balanced so many genres, oh, it's a perfect family movie, I think that's what they're talking about, because I feel like with Ghostbusters today, it would be for an older audience. And I know it wasn't marketed to kids. I know a lot of kids came to it through the cartoon. But I just think it's really one of those films that speaks to everybody regardless of age. So now I will say there were a few dissenting opinions. And again, some people coming to it through the cartoon. But the one that stuck out to me was somebody gave it, I'm in for 4.5 stars. This movie is so brilliant that even its fans don't get most of the jokes and references after years of watching. And I'm like, okay, dude. But, you know, to each their own. Anyway, I think that the consensus is this is a 5 out of 5. And anybody who argues with it is getting cross streams. That's what I say. So back to you, DK.
Thank you for that, Vian. It's very much appreciated, and I look forward to you haunting us once again in coming episodes.
Thank you to everyone who took part in this one. Apologies again if we didn't manage to read out your response, but as always, they're very much appreciated. And a special shout out to those in the Ghostbusters Facebook group for chiming in with this one. If there's ever a group that we're glad to have taken part, it's you guys. So thanks for that. And with that, it's time to round things off with our final thoughts. So, Mike, what are your final thoughts on this one, and score out of 5?
It's a film that really caught lightning in a bottle and was so successful they've been running out in every storm with bottles ever since, trying to do it again. I can see a lot of reasons why the film really took off and became a legit cultural phenomena. I personally think it's way too well known and popular to be a cult film, though I admit that the fans are certainly comparable. As a kid, like I kind of alluded to with our review of Scrooge, there was a sense you were seeing something subversive, grown up and almost forbidden. Multiple things leapt out of the movie and became icons: the song, the logo, the car, the gear, Slimer, Stay Puft. It's also not ashamed of its fantastical elements, which I think provokes the audience's imagination to let loose as well. Finally, it's genuinely very funny, with performers doing great stuff, but never undercutting the serious business of the plot, which Reitman, Aykroyd, and Ramis balance incredibly well. On the downside, some of the effects and attitudes have already dated terribly. It sometimes feels a bit too smug, and honestly, after so many viewings, it loses a bit of its sheen, so it might not have fantastic rewatchability. Or maybe I'm projecting my exhaustion from Sony's multiple lame attempts to make this quirky, outlandish comedy horror into a movie franchise that it really seems like it doesn't want to be. I still really dig the film, though. It's in every 80s child's DNA, but let's not pretend it's some shining beacon of cinema that should launch more stories in this fairly narrowly drawn world. And I gave it 3.5 out of 5. 3.5.
Fair enough. What about you, Suzanne?
I definitely think it fits into the 80s child mentality. You know, you didn't grow up in the 80s unless you saw it. And, you know, that's where your Gen X card kind of, that's one of the holes that gets punched in your Gen X card. As for it being a shining example of cinematic ability, no, but it's good fun. I think it's going to be held up as a classic. I think it's not as dated as everyone may think it is, although, yeah, the effects are. As far as its longevity, I am just amazed that it's still the cash cow that it once was. I'm amazed at how many people are still involved in it. Still, obviously, we're still talking about it here now, almost 40 years later. And it, I think, just is kind of this thing that lives in our memories as a good time in the 80s. And it's always going to be the thing that people are going to remember fondly as they look back over it and as they watch it again. It loses some sheen as you watch it over and over. But I also think that I think the quotability of it makes it more fun. I think if you can watch it with a group of people and sit there and see who can outquote each other, I think that's where the fun of it lies for people our age. And honestly, I think I'll give it 4 out of 5 stars.
Nice. What about you, Whaley?
Ghostbusters is like a nice warm blanket. It's there's something about it to me that it's just always going to be there. And no matter how many times I watch it, the sheen is still there for me. It hasn't gone away. Like, there's some small things with it, with, you know, little problematic things here and there. But honestly, for movies in the 80s, this is nowhere near on the top of list of problematic movies or problematic themes or anything in a movie. But this one is just something that I think young people today can still watch and enjoy it. It just like us older people are still enjoying it. I don't know. It seems like it's always been there for me. And it's always going to be there for me if I want it to be, especially as long as I keep physical media. I don't know. It's one of my favorites. It always has been since I was 10. And it's always going to be on that list of my top movies. So I'm going to be the Ghostbusters fanboy and give it, you know, 5 out of 5 for me. But I think it's partially the movie and what the movie actually means to me, and it is why I go that far with it. I think realistically 4, 4.5, but, you know, I'm going to give it a 5.
That's fair enough. Everybody's pretty much covered the points that I was going to say anyway. So my conclusion is just going to say the flowers are still standing. And I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 myself, which, looking at it, gives it 4.1 out of 5 as an average. So I think that's pretty good. I think that's a fairly big Twinkie, decent enough score. What about you guys?
Yeah, I think so.
Can I leave you with one final funny story that we haven't brought up yet about the film, by the way?
Go on.
There's a fantastic story I read about the original actress who plays Goza, because, you know, she was dubbed over because she had such a very strong accent. But she recorded all the dialogue initially, and apparently when she said the line about the destructor will come, choose and perish, Bill Murray would mock what her accent sounded like. So apparently he constantly kept on saying, we have no Jews and berries here, because that's what it sounded like she would say.
Oh my god. Going back, do you know who was originally going to play Goza?
No.
No.
It was going to be Paul Rubens.
Oh, right.
What?
I did hear that. I think I have heard that.
Yeah, he was going to turn up as Ivor Shandor at some point, and it was going to be Paul Rubens. That would have been a
Pee-wee Gozer? No.
Yeah, that would have been
Hey, actors are actors.
Yeah, it's now been 40 years. They're still, to some extent, trying to recapture that lightning in a bottle. So it shows that this made quite an impact back in the day, and still, you know, it still captures people's imaginations. So, that pretty much wraps it up for this bonus episode. We hope you out there have enjoyed listening as much as we've enjoyed talking over each other. All that's left for me to do is thank my guest today for taking part. So, first of all, Mr. Wilson, I'd like to thank you for making that decision to join us.
Thank you. You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, and I hope that there's something salvageable in the edit.
Yes. Good luck, Nick. Anything you'd like to mention while you're here?
No, I mean, you know the usual stuff we mentioned. So, you can find all of our links in the episode descriptions, and you can always find us on Silver Screen Podcast or Hit or Miss Star Trek Podcast or around. I'm on social media around the internet, and I tend to speak for DK because he's a hermit. So.
Yes, that's me. Cool. Also, a big thank you to our first timers here on Cult Classics for joining us today. Whaley, Suzanne, thank you. Have you had a pleasant time?
Yes, it was fun. Thank you.
Great time.
Cool. Nice one. If the opportunity arises, would you be up for returning at some point?
Yeah.
Yep. For sure.
Cool.
Love to.
Nice one. That's good to hear. I'll come to you first, Suzanne. Anything you'd like to plug while you're here? Any social media that the listeners can find you on?
Unfortunately, no. I have no links. I have no social media other than Facebook. But if you find me on Facebook, hey, I'll accept your friend request.
Cool. How about you, Michael? Any current upcoming projects you'd like to get the word out about? Any social media people can find you on?
Sure. Instagram is always Michael Whaley. It's C. Michael Whaley on Facebook. And I think it's CM Whaley on Twitter. I will refuse to call it X. I'm getting ready to start pre-production on a next short film horror comedy called Demon. Actually, February 1st, we're going to start some crowdfunding for it. But it's about a guy who summons a demon to help him out. But the demon's woke and the person's a misogynist, and it's pretty fun. when the demon is the voice of truth and good is what's funny about it. So I'm going to be crowdfunding for that shortly. And then hopefully in the next year and a half, we'll do my first feature, which is going to be called Zombie Western Musical. And it's exactly what it sounds like.
Oh, I want to see that. I want to see that already. We'll make sure we put the links in the description so people can find you for the, for not only for you, but for the crowdfunding if you've got it. So nice. Thank you all again for being part of this one. And thank you to you out there for being on this one with us. If you've liked what you've heard, please like, subscribe, share the Silver Screen podcast with your friends to help spread the word. And if you're feeling particularly generous, tips on our Ko-fi account are always gratefully received. And as always, if you get the urge, you can reach out to us or Mike on social media. Links to both of those and the Ko-fi in the description. I would also like to give an extra special thank you on today's episode to the Alessi brothers for their kind permission allowing us to use their song from the Ghostbusters soundtrack. And if, like me, you're a fan, you can find more of their music at their official website, alessibros.com, including a special CD release for the song Saving the Day, which is Saving the Day, every version there is or ever was. And again, I'll post a link to that in the description, so please do go check it out. And once again, thanks, guys.
Ghostbusters Frozen Empire comes out in a few days, so hopefully this has whetted your appetite. Fingers crossed anyone lives up to the OG. And if you do find it disappointing, don't worry, we'll be back in just a couple of weeks as we open up the coming month with a look at the seminal anime classic Akira. So, put on your clown makeup, get your bike tuned up, and we'll see you there. Until then, folks, it's been a blast, and remember, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes. Night all.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast, created, written, and hosted by DK. Produced by Mike Wilson. Editing by Nick. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Saving the Day, used by kind permission of the Alessi brothers. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.